This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of February 21st, 2022, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. You know, one of the most interesting things about growing up in a city and then living there as an adult is that you tend to develop a sense of ownership, which is terrific for civic involvement, but also I think a sense that you pretty much know all there is to know about that place. In reality, I think we know about the neighborhoods where we grew up. We know the schools we attended, the places where we worked, the sports teams we followed, probably the most obvious stuff that you'd see on the news. But there are whole universes of experiences in your hometown that you're just not privy to. You can try to educate yourself, but that can turn into a big project. Incredibly, if you were interested in getting an authoritative history of African Americans in Indianapolis since the city's founding in 1821, you'd be out of luck. There isn't one. At least, there wasn't one until last week. Historian David Leander Williams has done the considerable legwork and detective work necessary to write the first comprehensive history of the Black community in Indianapolis. It was just published by Indiana University Press. It's called African Americans in Indianapolis, the story of a people determined to be free. Most of us longtime residents know the highlights. Entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker, for example, international sports star Marshall Major Taylor, the successes of Crispus Attucks High School. But Williams offers a much deeper dive into the advancements of the Black community from 1820 to 1970, as well as horrendous acts of violence and pervasive racism African Americans encountered. As the title suggests, this is a book about determination and the persistent pursuit of freedom and equality while facing an endless array of challenges. David Leander Williams is our guest this week. He's an Indianapolis native and a proud graduate of Crispus Attucks. He grew up around the Indiana Avenue Commercial and Entertainment District that for many decades was a center of Black life in Indianapolis. And in fact, he has written two books about Indianapolis's music history, Indianapolis Jazz, The Masters, Legends, and Legacy of Indiana Avenue, and Indianapolis Rhythm and Blues. Happily, those will figure into some of our early questions. Here's our discussion. I am very pleased to welcome to the podcast David Leander Williams, historian and author of African Americans in Indianapolis, The Story of a People Determined to Be Free. Thank you so much for making time today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I hope you don't mind. I want to start with a question about your own personal history so our listeners can get a sense of how you've had a front row seat to the significant people, places, and events in Indianapolis's recent history. I had seen in an interview that you did some years back with the Indianapolis Public Library, you said that your father was very good friends with Wes Montgomery, who of course was from Indianapolis, widely believed to be the best and most influential jazz guitarist in history. What do you remember about him from that time, which I think you said was around the early 1960s?
Yes, the early 1960s. My earliest remembrance is on a Saturday morning, I was putting down a vinyl floor with this very toxic smelling glue that they had. And he came in the door with my dad, and he stood at the door and this big smile. And my dad introduced me to Wes Montgomery. He said, "David, I want to introduce you to Wes Montgomery." So I didn't know Wes Montgomery from, you know, Who Shot John. So I shook his hand. What I remember so clearly about him is he was a very a big man with very big hands, and he smiled and very, very sociable and personable. And I really just enjoyed being in his atmosphere. And from that, I remember later on, he and my dad would work in different recording studios. And I remember that he went to California in the early 1960s, and he would store his guitar in our basement when he was in Indianapolis, but he had a similar guitar in California and New York and other places where he may have performed. But I do remember clearly him having his guitar stored on top of a gigantic sound system that we had, speaker system, was called, we called it Big Bertha. But it was there for about an entire year, and we would go down and pluck on the strings. And what I remember so clearly, we had a record player down there, and I remember Etta James singing Waiting for Charlie to Come Home. So whenever I would hear that record, I would think about being in our basement at 515 West 24th Street, listening to Etta James sing At Last, Waiting for Charlie to Get Home, while I was thumbing on Wes Montgomery's guitar. But he was a very, very nice person. Yeah. And I know that what happened, he would come in town and perform at the various jazz clubs. And after the matinee was over, he'd come over to our house and spend the entire day. And remember, many of the weekends that he would be at our house, he would play his guitar on our front line. And people would from the neighborhood would come around and stand in front of our house listening to Wes Montgomery playing the guitar.
How is it that he and your dad had become friends or had become acquainted?
They, you know, worked together in jazz. I know he would perform in many of the jazz clubs around there. And my dad was, you know, electronic engineer, and he set up the sound system and recording systems.
Wow, that's an amazing story. I've got one more question related to your personal history, and I guess kind of parenthetically, your dad, since he grew up, or you guys were on West 24th Street, that I think will help listeners kind of put you in the larger context of your book. So I grew up in Indianapolis, but I grew up on the north side in Bernie Kessler, very quiet, placid, middle class, upper middle class existence. This was the late 1960s, early 1970s. At the same time, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, Interstate 65 is being constructed through the northwest section of downtown, including within a couple of blocks where your dad lived on West 24th Street.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in the book, you briefly touch on the devastating effect of running the interstate through a portion of the city that is primarily African American. What do you personally remember about the effect of the construction on the community there?
Well, I can even go back earlier, a few years before, my mother attended college classes. She took math and nursing classes at the Indiana University Extension, which was located on Delaware. So I remember she would leave work. She was a registered nurse. She would leave work and go down to the Indiana University Extension. And I remember her coming home saying, oh, wow, you know, they're going to construct one building in the Lockfield Gardens neighborhood where I was born, and I'll be able to get home earlier. So that one building metastasized into an entire university complex. So that was the first salvo. Yeah, the second salvo was the.
You're talking about what became the IUPUI campus.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And then the second one was when they ran the US 65 through the neighborhood. It just totally destroyed the neighborhood. So a lot of the cultural aspects of the neighborhood was the jazz, the people, the rhythm and blues and what have you, the nightclubs, and the neighborhood was destroyed totally by the encroachment of Indiana University, Purdue University, a medical center, and the highway that really ran through and destroyed our neighborhood.
Oh, so 1970 is the far bookend for the period that your book covers. It begins in 1820. But before that, in the preface of the book, you discuss the need to write about African-Americans in Indianapolis. And I gathered that the short answer is, well, no one really had written about the history of Black Americans in Indianapolis. How were you personally moved to tackle this subject?
There was like a number of reasons. What first was that I was a student at Colorado State University, and I would go down to Denver on the weekends to get my hair cut. And there were a lot of people from Indianapolis who were relocated to Denver in the early 1950s. Hmm. So the newspaper the barbershop that I was at, I would see the newspapers, and each week I would see that something was disappearing from my old neighborhood. So I realized at a later date that the neighborhood was slowly but surely being dismantled by urban renewal. So I thought at that time that I should come back and record little segments of the jazz community, the rhythm and blues community, and And that's what I wanted to do. And also, I knew that there was a comprehensive panoramic view, historical view of African Americans in Indianapolis. And I like to write, so I decided to do that also, because there was a very, very bustling community with various ethnic groups, the African American residents who lived in public housing. We had a very, very strong Jewish presence on the Indiana Avenue, and a very warm relationship with our, our Jewish brothers and sisters who had shops, and I wanted to also include them in that too, also because during the war, my grandparents told me that during the Great Depressions, when we were barely eating, many of the Jewish grocery store owners would give us food, if we were hungry. And many a time my grandfather would run behind the store, he'd come in and the owner said, "Oh no, we don't have anything here. I'm sorry, we're just out." And then he would wink at my grandfather, and my grandfather would go around to the side door, and there'd be a big bushel basket of meat, eggs, whatever. So we ate. So I want to also include that warm relationship that we had. So with that in mind, when I came back, I was able to write the history. My first book, I focused on jazz. The second book was on rhythm and blues. My fourth book will be on the warm relationship between the African-American and Jewish community during this time period. It was fantastic.
And so that's your next project.
Yeah. And can I also say that there was a lady there named Miss Ida Nikbar. She was a Holocaust survivor from Poland in the 1940s. And she had a small store, very, very impoverished store. She was a widow. She had children who really kind of didn't visit her often. And she was very sad about that. But she took many of us, a few of us young kids from the project under her wings, and made sure we went to school, to make sure that she tutored us in our studies. She made sure that we were going to class. She would even teach us Yiddish language. I mean, I was able to count from 1 to 10 in Yiddish. And when I would be bad, she would call me and say, "David, now I want you to go to school and do better." And she used to call me a teacher when I would act up in Yiddish. That was like a little bad naughty boy. And so I want to develop a book dealing with the warm relationship from a little poor African-American kid, myself and my late great buddy, Robert Earl Powell, and how she was able to nurture us and put us on the right track. And I want to talk about the striking similarities between these two histories in world history, about what she had experienced during the Holocaust and what my family experienced being chased out of McKenzie, Tennessee by the Ku Klux Klan in the early 1930s. So that's my next project.
What are some of the events recorded in this book that have not appeared before in print, or at least might be surprising to somebody who already has a pretty good grasp of Indianapolis history?
Well, some of the surprising events would be the fact that in 1821, there was a flood that occurred at the White River. There was a somewhere up the stream, there was blockage, and the area of Indian Avenue was flooded. And during that time period, the banks of the White River was occupied by German and Irish settlers. And when the flood occurred, then of course follows the anopheles, mosquito, malaria outbreak, and people were dying. People and livestock were dying on the banks of the White River. So the German and Irish residents moved to higher lands and other parts of the city. So simultaneously, there were escaped slaves coming in from Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kentucky to Indianapolis. So they saw that available real estate, so they were able to occupy those vacant shanties on the on the White River. And then from there, that's really was the genesis of Indian Avenue. And from that point on, the for spiritual needs, the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church was formed in 1836, and which is actually still there today, and after all these years, and that history is so great. And also, and a few years later, US 40 was constructed by the federal government to run through to Indianapolis, and there was a work crew there manned by a gentleman by the name of he's a German gentleman by the name of David Burkhart, and he was a rowdy gentleman, and with all his workers, and he would go at night and steal chickens out of people's backyards and vegetables or whatever. So what was interesting is that with all his activity, it all ceased one day in Military Park. Well, I just left there 10 minutes ago, where he was, there was a very distinguished, well-respected minister there. That name was Reverend James Haven. He was there conducting a revival there in Military Park. So Dave Burkhart and his buddies went to the revival, and they were in the back. They were half drunk, cursing, causing a scene. So Reverend, he appealed to them. It was saying, could you please hold it down, you know, and respect the sanctity of this ceremony. And they continued. So what he did, he walked off the off the pulpit or the stage. And when I think about him, I think about the Father Mulcahy in MASH. And as he approached, the profanity intensified. So he had it. So what he did, he quietly said, well, if you're not gonna, you know, going to, you know, obey, then I'll just have to do something. So everybody laughed. So what he did, he quietly, you know, ceremoniously took off his religious smock, his collar, folded it up, and handed it to one of the parishioners. He turned around, he grabbed David Burkhart by the neck, swung him around, and kicked his ass. Yeah. So from that time on, by his buddies, you know, he lost all the glory and the fame of being the tough guy.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast, and continuing our interview with historian David Leander Williams, author of the new book, African Americans in Indianapolis, The Story of a People Determined to be Free.
How do you research, or how did you research, these first Black residents in the first couple of decades of Indianapolis? But what kind of record keeping was there?
There was not really good record keeping. I was able to go through some of the old Bible story, Bibles from some of the African-American residents during that time period. I read every newspaper from about 1880, every African-American newspaper about 1880 up until 1970. And another thing that I had, to do, there were the German citizens were very, very politically influential in Indiana during this time period. So I was able to go to some of the German newspapers, and no, I do not, you know, I speak Spanish and Portuguese and a little Arabic, but I don't speak any Deutsch. So I was able to get one of my jazz heroes in Bloomington. This person was able to translate many of the German newspapers to English for me. So I was able to glean additional information about the African Americans in Indianapolis from about 1830s and 40s up until 1880s or 90s. Right. I read many of the newspapers that was translated back by my friends. So I was able to get a really around panoramic view of the evolution of African American histories from 1820 to the turn of the century.
Wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Bethel AME Church. What role did the church play over Indianapolis's first, I don't know, 5 or 6 decades for the Black community?
In the during this time period, after African Americans settled on Indiana Avenue on the banks of the White River, there was a need for a spiritual enlightenment, a spiritual comfort. There was a gentleman there who was a barber. He was well respected in the community. His bad name was Augustus Turner. And they had religious revivals in his barbershop very close to Indian Avenue. So from there, they prayed and meditated. So they were able to contact the African Methodist Episcopal headquarters in Philadelphia, saying that they were in need of spiritual enlightenment. So the church in Philadelphia dispatched a itinerant minister and an organizer by the name of Paul Quinn. So he came to Indianapolis and organized the Bethel AME Church in, I think, 1836. And originally it was on the downtown Indianapolis, exactly where the convention center is located right now. And from there they moved to 414 Vermont Street, which is downtown. And people, the historians have determined that the Underground Railroad was at the Bethel Church on Vermont Street, but it was not. The Underground Railroad was conducted in the church that was burnt down in the 1830s by some members of organizations who were anti-abolitionists. Right. They did not want African Americans in Indianapolis. So from that point on, Bethel was like the glue that held the African American community together and it ensured their cohesion. And even today, it still functions in that capacity. And I was able to, a few weeks ago, celebrate the 185th anniversary of Bethel AME Church. And I used to attend that church as well.
Yeah, and I gathered from the book that the church also helped attract and welcome new Black citizens in Indianapolis and kind of get them on their feet.
Yes, yeah, that's so true. That church, along with the Flanner House Social Service Agency of maybe three or four decades later, yes, I mean, they were able to, when ex-slaves and free people as well would come to Indianapolis, they would be directed to Bethel to get clothing, food, medical attention and employment attention. I mean, employment possibilities there. And it seems like it was a clearinghouse for recently arrived African American free and enslaved people from the Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kentucky. So it was the jewel in our community.
What was life in Indianapolis like for African Americans after the Civil War?
Well, during that time period, there was a lot of pro-Confederate, anti-African-American sentiment in Indianapolis. Many of whom were attacked in broad daylight. They were they could only live adjacent to the White River. Of course, menial jobs, and it was really, really, really tough. They could not go to school, so what would happen, Bethel AME Church would attract the more educated African-Americans, and they would have classes in the basement of Bethel AME Church, because at that time period, African-American children could not attend school. So that was another one of the functions of Bethel AME Church, education.
I think by 1895, the Indianapolis Recorder, the weekly newspaper, is founded. This is, I'm sure, a big topic, but what really was its key importance, do you think, to the development of the Black community? What role did it play?
It was a clarion call to the community. And originally, it was established as a printing company for religious material. It began as a religious publication sheet that was circulated in the community. And later on, it developed into a more powerful organ of communication. And it really kind of kept the African-American community abreast of all the latest developments in the community, to help them, give them a sense of being appreciated by the community and pointing them in the direction of liberation and acceptance.
As you round into the 20th century, what stands out to you as a defining figure or a really a defining moment?
Probably the establishment of Christmas Addicts High School, the high school of which I'm a proud alumnus. African Americans, up until about the 1920s, there was integrated education, but in the early 20s, a gentleman arrived in town by the name of David Curtis Stevenson, and that name might ring a bell. He was one of the grand dragons of the Ku Klux Klan of America, and he was a Houston-born racist who later on relocated to Evansville, Indiana, selling books door by door. Then he traveled up to Indianapolis, and he organized the local branch of the Ku Klux Klan. And during this time period, African Americans and white Americans were attending school together, but he did not like that. He called that racial mongreling, or some nefarious term. So he wanted to put an end to it. So he was able to get control of the city government. The governor, the mayor, many of the people, the city council, they were all clandestine members of the, that's an appropriate analogy, of the Ku Klux Klan. When they were forced to close the schools to African Americans, they said, well, let's put a little money aside to, and we'll establish something, you know, an inferior institution where the blacks could go to and get the little education that they needed just to be able to mop floors and wait tables and be butlers and maids. So they put money aside to establish Christmas Addicts High School. But to their surprise, the first principal of Christmas Addicts High School, a gentleman by the name of Matthias Naucox, came into power, and he was able to assemble the finest scholars in America to bring them to Addicts High School. We had people with advanced degrees when the other white schools did not. And one of the first scholars was a gentleman by the name of Dr. John Martin Finney, who spoke seven languages. He had about 8 or 9 degrees. He has a law degree, and he died maybe a decade or so ago, and he practiced law until he was 107 years old. But one gentleman, his name was Dr. Joseph Carroll. He got his PhD from the Ohio State University, and he wrote a book that, and I'm holding a copy of his book right now. It was called Slave Insurrections from, I think, 1850 to 1900s. He wrote a book then, and then Dr. Stanley Warren. But we had all these great scholars who came to Addicts, and the school system said, well, we're sending them to an inferior institution, so they're going to fail, and everyone would be happy. But no, to the other extreme, you know, many of them, the majority, you know, the overwhelming majority receive a world-class education, and they're doing great things around the world as we speak today.
I'm sure it's hard to go through this whole history without then thinking about what the challenges are for the Black community in Indianapolis here in the 21st century. Did you give any thought to that?
First thing would be employment. A lot of the, and this is my estimation, my own, you know, that a lot of the problems, the social problems we have today are directly related to the lack of employment. When I was, you know, in high school, if you weren't a scholar or a great basketball player like Oscar Robertson or whatever, you know, there was, you know, the chance of going to college, you know, very, very slim. But at the same time, you had jobs, and I can name some of the places: the post office, the Ford plant, the Chrysler plant, the Chevy plant, National Starch, Naval Avionics, Diamond Chain, RCA, and all these high grade. There were many jobs where you could go and get, you know, you could get gainful employment and raise your family. But slowly but surely, these jobs disappeared. So the next big industry that came into the city was the drug trade. So from that time on, you know, it's been a downward spiral with as far as jobs and the community. So I really lament the fact that the business sector totally disappeared from Indianapolis and left behind a broken community. So I'm very, and then, but what I want to do in my books, I want to help to try to empower this young generation with the history of their true history, to make them feel proud about from whence they come, and so they will be able to do better. I do know There are no jobs here, but if I could just somehow make them aware of their true history, then my humble, as I put in my book, you know, I can't with my book solve all the social ills in Indianapolis. I mean, I'm not the silver bullet, but if I could just provide a few grains of gunpowder, then my humble effort would not have been in vain.
So the book was released this month, is that right?
Yeah, February the 8th, last week, by Indiana University Press. My first two books were on jazz and entertainment, and jazz and rhythm and blues. One book, jazz, the other book, rhythm and blues, by the History Press in South Carolina. But this book, African Americans in Indianapolis, the story of a people determined to be free, was published by Indiana University Press at Bloomington. And I was very happy that a university press decided to publish my book, especially at this time of, this movement to ban African-American history, which I think is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, best of luck with the book. And I look forward to reading the fourth book that you discussed earlier in the interview. Mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating.
Right. And about a week or so, my book will be, all my books will be available on my website is davidleanderwilliams.com. David, D-A-V-I-D, Leander, L-E-A-N-D-E-R, Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-N-S.
My thanks again to David Leander Williams. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest edition of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Indianapolis has put more than $30 million into its Violent Crime Prevention Grants Program since 2009, but homicides have skyrocketed. Leslie Bonilla Muniz reports that as the city plans to spend $45 million in federal pandemic money for programs aimed at quelling violent crime, some stakeholders want to see clear-cut results. Also in this week's issue, Dave Lindquist explains why many Indy area restaurant owners have unfinished business with the underfunded Federal Restaurant Revitalization Fund. And Mickey Shuey explores the question of whether Indianapolis should try to nab hosting duties for another Super Bowl when warm weather cities and those with new NFL stadiums are obviously favored. You can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or obviously online at IBJ.com. It's a little easier said than done, but I can guarantee you access if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for all of the latest news about local business and politics, plus all of IBJ's data about the Central Indiana economy and corporate community. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.